If they can't do insight meditation, I'll teach them vipassana. If they can't do vipassana, then I teach them body scan. If they can't do body scan, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they've forgotten. That's what they started off with. And the reason I do this is because they are all the same. There's no difference between all of these. And if anybody just wants to check this out, have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta. Anapanasati. There, the Buddha says very clearly, anyone who does the Anapanasati also does the four foundations of mindfulness at the same time. And four foundations of mindfulness, isn't that insight, vipassana? It is, yeah. So when you do the samatha of Anapanasati, you're doing satipatthana at the same time. See, I'm right. You do samatha, or washing the breath, insight, kindness, it's all the same. All you ever teach anybody is putting down the cup. That's the only thing which I teach people. That's the only thing which the Buddha gave to people. But people, they try one thing and they can't do it, so we have to give them another example, and then another example, and then until they get the hang of it, that's all. But it's all exactly the same stuff. So that's the subject of meditation the Buddha gave people as well. It doesn't really matter. As long as it's all about letting go, being kind, being gentle, that's all it is. So that's and how they got fruition. Talking about fruition, the best teaching of Ajahn Chah, the number one teaching of Ajahn Chah about meditation, which I like teaching in every meditation retreat, just to show that what I'm teaching now is deep, powerful stuff coming from someone like Ajahn Chah. A lot of you have heard this before, last year or elsewhere. He said his monastery was mango orchard. This was Wat Ma Pong in the north of east of Thailand. And he said those mango trees were planted by the Buddha himself. And those mango trees have got thousands of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes. All ripe. And he said, you monks, nuns, lay men, lay women, from Singapore, from Malaysia, or from wherever, you don't have to climb the tree to get one of those sweet, juicy mangoes. You don't need to shake the tree to get a mango to fall, nor do you need to throw a stick up to get the mangoes. All you need to do to get a mango to fall is sit underneath the tree, perfectly still, and open up your hand, and a mango will fall into it. That was Ajahn Chah. Brilliant. That's how fruition works. That's how meditation works. You sit down under the tree perfectly still. You shake that tree and try to make it happen, nothing falls at all. You throw a stick up, nothing falls except the stick, and it hits your head. You climb up there and you fall off. So the job is sitting perfectly still, opening up your heart, and all these amazing jhanas, insights, they happen to you. If you know a good friend who's ever got any great experience, they will tell you that's how it happens. You sit there doing absolutely nothing, perfectly still, and then these things occur. So that, if you want fruition, you've got to learn how to be perfectly still. You haven't not still enough yet. That's why things don't fall. You're still shaking the tree. Shh. Be still. And all these things come. Absolutely perfect teaching. Great simile from one of the great masters. Dear Ajahn, is worrying about others another delusion? Since the first noble truth is life is suffering. If I feel pain, grief, etc., and see other people suffering, I should go back to contemplating the Four Noble Truths. Right, thank you gratefully. Look, if I worry about your suffering and you worry about my suffering, there's even more suffering in the world. Isn't there enough suffering without worrying about things? The answer is, a very simple teaching, which is in opening the door of your heart, which is that story of the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan during the Six-Day War between Israel and goodness knows how many other countries in 1967. He was asked in the middle of that conflict, "What do you think about the problem in the Middle East?" And this statesman replied to the journalist, "There is no problem in the Middle East." "What do you mean?" said the journalist. "There is a war going on as we speak. What do you mean there's no problem there?" And the politician and statesman said very quietly, "Sir, a problem is something with a solution. There is no solution in the Middle East. Therefore, it can't be a problem." Now, that is brilliant. Why worry about things where you can't make a difference? If you can do something, then worry about it. It's a problem, because it has a solution. But if there's no solution, then stop worrying about it. Isn't that rational, logical? It helps us to say, "Well, there's nothing I can do, so I'm just going to do nothing." And sit there and stop worrying so much. Because you can't do anything. In fact, you're part of the problem. When you worry about other people, then you get crazy and you cause me more problems. So out of compassion for me, the teacher, stop worrying about other people. You're worrying about them, they're worrying about you, you're all crazy. So stop worrying. And remember, just we're all owners of our karma. One of the nicest things we can do is when you're peaceful, when you stop worrying and thinking, there's something we call like energy. When one person is very peaceful, you know, other people are peaceful in the room. So if you're worrying, it's like a virus and it affects everybody. We all stop worrying. It's amazing just how many times when one person has a good meditation, a deep meditation, so many other people at the same time seem to have a good meditation. There seems to be like some resonance between people. So if you're worrying about other people, you're actually encouraging other people to worry too. You're not helping them at all. So, as they say in Australia, no worries, mate. Okay, so no worries. How can I differentiate whether I've entered a deeper stage of meditation or I was just dozing off? Usually, it's just a rule of thumb is how you feel afterwards. If you've dozed off, when you wake up again, you feel dull. If it's a deep meditation, you feel huge amounts of energy. I could run up and down the hill faster than Usain Bolt. So if that's how you feel, then that was a deep meditation. If you feel it's just a struggle just to, you know, get up the steps to the higher cottages, then that was slop and torpor. That's usually the way. So if you are worrying about that, just run up the hill. See what happens. And if you can go very quickly, great. It was you had deep meditation. And if you can't, at least it will wake you up. Dear Venerable, a doctor once told me that there cannot be a state of no thought. That's crazy. State of no thought, you do that all the time. Well, not all the time, but a lot of the time. Today I experienced a state of no thought. Yes, so you disprove the doctor. At least 99% of the time I saw a silent movie of meaningless things, as though through a video camera. I was not sleeping. I was aware of people moving around me. It was a pleasant feeling. Good. I did not want to lose it. Good. But I remembered your teaching to remain calm and not get excited. When I finally broke off, 1 hour had passed. Oh, what a pleasant thing to do. Okay, it was a silent movie. Next time that happens, see if it can be not a movie, but just one picture. And when it's one picture, so it's not moving, still. And in that picture, find out the most beautiful part of that picture and go to that. see if you can just go into things rather than having too much diversity. But it's still good. You weren't thinking or reacting. That's why it lasted a long time. So now some of these doctors, please, there's many good doctors here. I'm talking about psychologists and neurologists and stuff. Some of them haven't got enough data to understand what is going on. Sometimes you get people, the amazing data. You know what that story I wrote in the Happiness Through Meditation of one of the people here, not in this room here, but who comes to our center in Nolamara. And he was the one who was meditating at home on a Sunday afternoon. And nothing on the TV, so he told his wife, I am going into my bedroom to meditate for about half an hour. About 45 minutes was his maximum. And after about an hour and a half, he had not emerged from his room. So his wife went in there to check on him. And when she went into the bedroom, he was still sitting there, cross-legged, perfectly still. Too still, because she couldn't see his abdomen moving up and down. She got closer. He wasn't breathing. Ah! So she rang up the emergency number. What's the emergency number in Australia? I should know this. Say? Oh, 000, that's right. I go to so many countries, I get confused where it's 118 or 999 or Jeepers, or 811. Anyway, 000. So he rang 000, and within 5 minutes the ambulance had come. We trained medics, and they rushed into the room to feel his pulse. There was no pulse. No pulse at all. So they put him on the gurney, on the stretcher, straight into the ambulance, and with the wife with him. She was so scared, it looked like he was dead. They rushed to the hospital, which was the Charles Gairdner Hospital, which is in Netherlands, for those of you who know. Rushed there, with the sirens wailing, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, straight through the red lights, zoom! It was an emergency, and they got straight into the hospital, rushed him straight into the emergency room, checked. Well, first of all, ECG. See if there's any heartbeat. A flat line, ding, 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 emergency. It does not go ding, ding, ding. I make that up because it makes the story more interesting. Ding, 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 emergency. No heartbeat, but it was a flat line. And they had an EEG on his brain as well. Another flat line. He was dead. The best equipment. No heartbeat, no brain activity, totally gone. And it was a Sunday afternoon. Not many people were working there. So the doctor's first thought, send him to the morgue. He was very lucky they did not send him to the morgue, because when he came out of meditation later on, he'd have killed the attendants working down in the morgue. Imagine working down in the morgue and you've got a dead body, and suddenly he comes up, hi guys, what am I doing? That would be very scary. But as fortune has it, the doctor who was on duty that afternoon, he was an Australian Indian man. His parents had migrated here. And because he was half Indian, now he'd heard his parents talk about all these yogis, you know, in India, who can actually stop all their life activities. And he heard from his wife, he'd been meditating, he added one and one together, he got two. He thought, maybe he's just in deep meditation. So he put defibrillators, electric shock, boom! Boom! As, you know, your body goes above the table, trying to get his heart going. Nothing worked. It didn't actually tell me how long it was, but it was a long time, many times, the doctor didn't give up, until finally he just decided to come out of his meditation. Not because of defibrillators. He just, time to come out, he opened his eyes, he bent up and said, "Where am I? I was in my bedroom, what am I doing in hospital?" And the doctor, as soon as he came out, beep, 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 perfect heartbeat, brain activity was normal. And the doctor gave him thorough checkup, blood pressure, whatever else, and he was 100% fit, nothing wrong with him. So the doctor allowed him to walk home. That's how confident the doctor was. And he said the only unpleasant part of the whole experience, because while he was in this deep meditation, he was totally blissed out, perfectly aware. No doubt, not dozing off, but totally aware, the most amazing state he'd ever had. And he said the only unpleasant part was when he walked home. He said, "You wouldn't believe the scolding he got from his wife." She was on him all the way home. "Don't you ever do that again. Don't you know what you did to me? I thought you were dead. Well, I'm going to tell the children, don't ever do that again, you're a terrible man." But apart from that, it was just the most amazing experience. And the lovely part of that, because the wife was there, she saw all the flat lines, was the fact that there was a guy who got into a deep meditation, and for once, they took him to hospital, they put all the machines on him. Absolutely no heartbeat for maybe an hour or two. No discernible brain activity. And when he came out, perfectly okay. Isn't that awesome? So if that happens to you, you don't have to worry about anything. You're perfectly safe. And for those of you who think, what happens if the doctor on duty is not Indian? Suppose he's this Ocker Australian. He's dead. Cremate him. Again, you don't have to worry. Because there is a story in the sutras. It's in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Where a monk in the time of the Buddha was meditating in the jungle. And when some villagers passed by, they too thought he was dead. They couldn't find any sign of life in him at all. And even if you try that flashlight trick, open your eyes and put a flashlight still, it would look like you're dead. So, they decided, you cannot leave a holy monk to be eaten by the jungle animals. And they were in the forest anyway. Much wood was readily available. So, they built funeral pyre. It took them half an hour. And they put the monk on top. And then they did whatever chanting they knew and lit the fire. And when the fire was established, they knew the monk would be burnt. So off they went to do their job. They'd already spent a lot of time cremating this old monk. And the fire was burning when they left. And the following morning, they got up early in the morning and they were so surprised and impressed to see the monk walk on arms round in their village. No burns, even his robes were not charred, not even singed at all. Because it's what happens to you. If you get into these deep meditations, you can't even be cremated. If they try that, I remember I've been to the crematorium in Singapore just by the reservoir. What's that called? It's a woodland somewhere, isn't it? Manda. Yeah, I've been there. They put them in the big ovens. If they do that, if you're in jhana or deep meditation, they do that to you. When they pull the oven out, they say, "Hi, it's me again." You'll be perfectly there, okay, nothing wrong with you. Of course, it'll scare the you-know-what out of the people who are working in that place. And you'll probably get your face on the Straits Times or the Evening News. But it'd be a really cool thing to do, wouldn't it? So you don't have to worry. You can't die in those states. So if there's a big bushfire here, because there's bushfire. This is no bushfire season at the moment because it's been too wet. If you have a big bushfire, or there's a meteor coming, an asteroid coming from outer space heading for Singapore, and it's, there's no escape. Meditate. Get into jhana. The asteroid does whatever it was, and when you come out of jhana, there you are. You're alive. Singapore's gone, but you're alive. It's a cool thing to do. Well, I better carry on like this. What am I doing? Okay, don't decide. Finally broke off. Yes. So that's what happens when you get deep meditation. I sometimes seem to tenaciously cling on to thinking for dear life, perhaps petrified of the alternative, peace, freedom, insight. It's a drug, it's dukkha, a habit, its power and momentum amazes me, and sometimes it's obviously not right. Why does the mind fear stillness, awareness and mindfulness at the present? There's two reasons. One, because it's the unknown. Now, we're always afraid of the unknown. But I don't know, how many people are here for the first time? Put your hand up. Okay, quite a few of you. When you first come here, you don't know where things are, so there's always a bit of tension. And, you know, sometimes you see me for the first time, think, oh, it's a monk, I've got to do this to a monk and that to a monk, and I can't do this and I must respect him. It gets really hard being around a monk for the first time. You don't know what you're supposed to do, so you really tense up. And after a while, you've been around me for a while, it doesn't matter what you do. I'm just a nice, kind monk. So you relax. You go through these three stages of, say, coming here. Recognition, you recognize the place, the people, where your room is, the keys, and where how everything works, where to get a cup of tea, where the other toilets are. You recognize it. Once you get past recognition, you get to familiarity. If it's not happened yet, by the end of these 9 days, your room will be like your room, your little nest, that's my room, and you feel very comfortable there. It's like your second home. Already some of you have been coming here year after year after year, and it is like your home. You know exactly what it is. It's like you're coming back again. You recognize it, familiarity, and then you get to the last stage, which is total ease. You're totally relaxation here. Recognition, familiarity, and ease. The three stages when you first come here. Or you meet somebody. You know, you recognize who they are, and then you become familiar with them, then you can relax in their presence. And that's the same with even silence. The first thing, you've got to recognize what silence actually is. A lot of people don't know what you're talking about by silence. Fortunately, you live, you know, in this jhana grove, and it's a very quiet place. The silence is all around you. Try and find a quiet place like this in Singapore. There isn't such a place. There's always noise. But here, you go outside in the evening or in the early morning, there's no sound at all. Even the animals, the kangaroos, they don't make much noise. There's no cicadas. This is one of the quietest places in the world, Australia. So you get to know what silence is. And once you recognize it, you become familiar with it. It's like an old friend. And then you're not afraid of it anymore. You can relax. So this is just the stages. It's just stages of psychology. Eventually the silence, it becomes an old friend. And you don't try and keep it. It's with you for a lot of the time, like a good friend is. You don't put in effort staying with a good friend. It's natural. You like to be with them. So those are the stages. The second reason why we're afraid is because thinking has a lot to do with one's ego and sense of identity. When Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, he didn't realize what happens when you don't think. I don't think, therefore I'm non-self. Because when you think, it's actually you feel that you are existing, you're doing something, you are. Which is one of the reasons why it's scary not to think. It's as if some of your identity disappears. But it's nice. It's a sheer pleasure and the peace. I like giving the simile. When I was in Penang one Christmas evening, after teaching a retreat and answering all the questions, I went to my room to take a well-deserved rest. But in the temple there, in the opposite to my room, was a layperson's house, and they were having Christmas party. And their Christmas party was karaoke. I've never done karaoke, I've only heard it once, I never want to hear it again. There were people, because there must have been Christians in the house, they were taking lots of drink, being very silly. And the the more it got to me, so we finished about 9:30, so I was up there by 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, by midnight, that was when they were singing totally out of tune, in a loud voice. People, when they're drunk, they think they can sing like Frank Sinatra, and they cannot. It's like a howling banshee, like a cat wailing. Whatever it is, it doesn't sound human at all, but something from the lower realms. And that's what it sounded like, and I could not go to sleep. And it was terrible stuff. So that's, you know, but then it finished at last. At last they were tired, about 1 o'clock. Oh, what a relief. It was peaceful at last. Now that's what happens when you get still in your mind. All that thinking is like karaoke. Out of tune, getting nowhere, stupid stuff. And it finishes at last. Ah, oh, now I can be peaceful. So when you realize what the stillness is, it's delicious. It's like you're very hungry for something and now you get fed. You get fed stillness. So when it does happen, you soon get very used to it and you love it. It's beautiful. So that's what overcomes the fear. It's just too nice. Iyabhante, every time when piti sukha arises, the doer quickly appears. What to do? Nothing. The doer quickly appears. What to do? You say, what not to do? So, this is the joy comes, and then you start to get involved with it. So the next time, pause. See if you can press the pause button, you know, in your brain. You know sort of the pause button? So everything freezes. So you've got piti sukha, joy, pause. Just wait for a few moments. If you can do something after a second or 2 seconds, allow yourself to do something. But for just a short period, don't do anything. Deliberately stop. Sometimes in my method of meditation, people say, what about right effort? You always say that we're not supposed to do anything. Bhad Ajahn Brahm, the Buddha said, factor number 5 of the eightfold, no, 6 of the eightfold path is right effort. Where is the right effort, Ajahn Brahm? And the effort is to stop, to say no, to renounce, to restrain, to let go, to be kind. Those are the efforts. It's like it's like the effort to stop things, not to do more things. So it does take a little bit of effort just to freeze. Take your hand away so you don't do anything. Just the effort to be kind, which is another way of not doing things. Opening the door of your heart, no matter what's happening. It's not interfering with people. Allowing this moment to be. Happy to be here, not wanting to get somewhere else. That takes effort to be free. So those are the efforts. They're not the usual form of effort which you are commonly employ. Pushing, forcing, making things happen. It's resisting that, restraining, stopping. Those are the right efforts. So when piti sukha comes up, exert that right effort to stop, restrain, stop yourself interfering with it. See what happens. And then the piti sukha stays. It gets even better. And you have a happy time. And you don't ask for your money back after the retreat. Now I always say that, it's very true. You can always, after any retreat, anything done by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, any book you get, any donation you make, if you're not satisfied, many of you made big donations to this retreat centre, if you're not satisfied with this retreat centre, you can always ask for your money back. That's a guarantee, promise 100%. Because, you know, I'm a monk, I can't tell lies. Whatever you do for our Buddhist Society of West Australia or Bodhidharma, if you're not happy, you can always ask for your money back. You won't get it back, but you're always allowed to ask. I should have been in business or politician or something. I'm not sure I understand what's a nimitta. I've heard accounts from practitioners of what they experience. The bright light, colors, etc. But what is it that gives rise to these experiences when the mind is still? What is the significance of these experiences? Thanks for entertaining my question. You will all, every one of you, experience a nimitta, sooner or later. Even Christians, Muslims, atheists, they all experience a nimitta sooner or later, when they die. Haven't you heard or read about near-death experiences? You leave your body, you see your dead old body lying there, and then you float off towards the light. That is the same thing as a nimitta you get in meditation. Why? Because when you're dead, your five senses have been suppressed. That's why you see this beautiful light. Exactly the same thing, it's your mind you're seeing. So everyone sees a nimitta sooner or later. It's best to actually see it now when you're still alive. Then you can come and ask me afterwards about what it means. Once you're dead, it's a bit difficult to ask me. So that's actually, so everyone does it sooner or later. And that's actually what it means. It's just the way that we experience the jitta. It is usually because that we are mostly visual persons. I'm not sure, maybe any neurologist here, that there's more of your brain deals with visual stimuli than anything else, which is why that we're so visual. That's why we recognize ourselves or each other by our faces. We've got pictures, visual images, and our passports. Now, we could have voice recognition in our passports, a little thing, and you know, you have to speak into the receiver and that finds out if you really are who you are. But it's mostly visual. And because it's mostly visual, that when we try and find out, you know, we have this experience, the five senses are gone, you've just got the mind left. We usually interpret that mind, we perceive it as if it was a vision. It is not seen through the eye, it is a mental phenomena, but we perceive it as a light. That's why these things are lights, but not like you see in the real world. They're mental perceptions. But that's how we experience it. It's a beautiful light. So that's what those nimittas are. And they're beautiful, they're good fun. So anyway, sooner or later you'll see one. If not now, later on. Please advise, how can meditation help in forgiving ourselves and others? When you meditate, you have to have this wonderful sense of letting go and kindness. Otherwise it doesn't work. You have to be kind to your body and kind to your mind. And only when there's kindness do you relax. That's why when it starts warming up in a few days, this is one of the things you must always turn off your mobile phones when you come in the meditation hall, because the penalty is your mobile phone will get reborn as parking meter, which is the lowest form of technology. You know, as far as technology is concerned, that's the lower realms. So don't do that to your mobile phone. But anyway, once you have an open heart, you can always forgive the person who put on the mobile phone. It's happened to you before, hasn't it? So it happens to each one of us, except for me, because I've got no mobile phone. It's wonderful not having a mobile phone. You feel so free. It means you're not controlled by that stupid thing. And ringing at all times in the middle of the night, or when you want some peace and quiet, just about to get enlightened, and this stupid person rings you to try and get you back to work. I'm on holiday. Get out. So the very reason why you develop deep meditation, by making peace, being kind, being gentle. You see that on the back of some t-shirts later on. That's basically how you meditate. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And That teaches you how to forgive, how to let go of the past. Don't judge people, don't judge yourself. All of that, the attitudes you learn in meditation, you're doing that on yourself first of all. Let go of all your past, doesn't matter what happened. Being kind to yourself, not judging yourself. Not judging this is a good meditation or a bad meditation, it's just meditation, that's all. Which means that you just don't judge. And you free yourself and you have the same attitude to other people. Totally forgive all sentient beings, no matter what they've ever done. Have I ever scolded any one of you here? Have I ever punished you? But hands up if you deserve to be punished. Of course you do. You've done terrible things. Asked me stupid questions. Kept me up late at night. Made me work so hard. Taking me all over to Singapore and to Melbourne and other places where I should be resting. But you're forgiven. Isn't it wonderful? You don't carry the pain of anger or guilt around. So after a while you find it very easy to forgive yourself and others if you carry on this meditation. Dear Ajahn, I have many Buddhist friends who do not meditate despite my persuasion. Why do I need to convince them? Don't convince them, use reverse psychology. Say that you're not up to the standard of to be able to meditate yet. But you know, I'm doing a lot for you to make sure that one day that you'll be able to rise to that level where you can go on a meditation retreat as well. Because when you make it sound like that, they really want to meditate. So, you know, use psychology. People know that they don't want to be excluded from things. So if we made this Ajahn Brahm's private, exclusive meditation retreat, it's amazing how many more people would apply. When it's exclusive, private. So, eventually though, that if it works for you, and they find that you're a more peaceful, kind, wise person, of course then they will want to meditate as well. But one of the reasons why many Buddhists don't want to meditate, because they've got this idea that if you go on a meditation retreat, it's having to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, sitting on the hard floor, not being able to be moved, being whacked with a Zen stick, eating terrible food, and having to listen to boring sermons, having to go through pain, and having to, you know, not eat anything at all in the afternoon, having to sleep in dormitories where everyone else is snoring, and you get up at 4 o'clock to do the same the next day. It's torture. There's so much pain in so many retreats that people get the idea, no, I don't want to go. Which is one of the reasons the Buddhist Fellowship I supported to the max of doing these executive retreats in 5-star hotels. Where people can meditate as much as they like. And you know, in a 5-star hotel, they know if they've got a sore back, they go to massage. They go to spa. You know, and get a hot spa or whatever else they get on the backs. And because it's a 5-star hotel, they associating meditation with holiday relaxation. Which is one of the other reasons that I never call these places like tough places. One of the nicknames for this retreat place is not just Jhana Grove, it is Club Med Perth. So when you go home, you say, where did you spend your holiday? Tell people, I went to Club Med Perth. Say, wow, that must have been really good. What did you do there? Say, secret. We're not allowed to tell people. But if you want to join next year, Club Med Perth, BF has a whole group of people going to Club Med Perth. And all these people say, oh yeah, I'll go. Club Med Perth. If it's comfortable, then people aren't afraid of it. Which is one of the reasons why from the executive retreats there's so many people who have never met, who would never had meditated. But when it's in a 5-star hotel, it's very nice. 5 precepts, first of all, for people. And they feel, oh, they can have their dinner in the evening. They can watch their TVs in their room if they want. If they get tired, they can always go shopping. I don't know why you go shopping. And that's one thing I can't figure out. You know, people from Singapore come to Perth to go shopping. People in Perth go to Singapore to go shopping. I mean, if those shops were better somewhere, you just go to one city. It's the same shops. You know, it's all just these franchises. There's no difference. So why is it people want to go overseas to go shopping? You just go in your own centre next door. Anyway, what was I doing about? What was I talking about? I don't know, you don't know. Anyway, I'm finished anyway. So let's go to the next question. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I suffer from bad migraines all my life. When I'm meditating, I bring forth an attack sometimes. Even if it doesn't become a full-fledged migraine, it causes slight pressure. So I've been using your body scanning method combined with loving kindness. Brilliant. I start with my head, sending a loving kindness and doing it for the rest of the body. It seems to work. Less pressure and migraines, but it doesn't go deep because the mind is busy scanning the body. What should I do? Do the scanning meditation until you really relax. When you relax, and then just leave the body alone and just let go. But keep on doing the kindness. The migraines are just, you know, the pressure which you have. And that pressure, any time you do something, strive and try to control or try to achieve something, you'll get the tension which may trigger off another migraine. So instead of that, just really do this beautiful, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Do the scanning first of all, and once the scanning is finished and you relax, then just, whatever you're experiencing, just make peace, be kind, be gentle. And you'll be surprised at how deep you get very quickly. It's not what you're watching, but how you're watching it. If you're watching it with any type of tension, you'll find you get the migraine again. You are very fortunate, whoever wrote this question. The reason is because you can't mess around. Every time you mess around and try and do something, you get this terrible pain. You know, there's one of the old members of our Buddhist society here. He died a couple of years ago. He told me that the way he got interested in Buddhism and meditation was when he was a soldier in the British Army. And he always suffered from migraines. And the only way he could overcome the migraines was go into a dark room, which is common, and he said he would go inside of himself, go deep inside to a place where he couldn't feel any of the pain. And, you know, he didn't realize this was meditation. But he told me that one day he was on maneuvers in Germany with the British Army, and he was like a sergeant, so the head of a troop of soldiers. And they were told over the radio to stop and have a cup of tea. And so the soldiers all stopped, and before they'd finished, when they started, he had this big migraine. There was a farm shed not far away. He said, look, I'm going to go in the farm shed because I got the migraine. And when the soldiers finished their cup of tea, they were told to move, and they forgot about the sergeant. So they actually left him in the shed. And they'd gone about a couple of miles down the road, and they thought, oh, we left him, we better go and get him. So apparently they turned around, went into the shed, and found him still sitting there. So they literally picked him up. These are soldiers, okay, these are not medics, these are soldiers, they're rough. And they just dumped him in the back of the truck. And then a few minutes later, he came out of his whatever he was in and said, hey, what am I doing here? I was in the shed. He never felt people picking him up. He never knew. He never heard the sound of the truck. Because, you know, when he told me that, he said, that must have been in a jhana. He said, it probably was. But he could only do that when he had migraines, because he had to. And a few years later, the migraines, they just went by themselves. He said, I can't get into those states anymore. And he always wished he could until he died. He said, when I had those migraines, it was forcing me to meditate. But when they disappeared, you know, my mind just couldn't do it anymore. It's a very interesting anecdote. So if you have the migraines, you know, there's a positive to that. You can't mess around, you have to meditate. You go deep inside to where the migraines can't reach you. Anyway, I find the various noises in the meditation hall distracting. people's movement, people asleep with sleeping noises. Should I persist despite these? I need to overcome my aversion, or is it the solution to find another place to meditate? You know that I was teaching meditation once in one place, and then one of the people, actually they fell asleep, and they started snoring, and then they suddenly woke up and said, "Somebody's snoring in here!" And it was them. They heard themselves snore, and it woke them up, and they thought it was somebody else. So, whoever wrote this question, are you sure it wasn't you? The point is, we all make noises. You can't avoid that. So you have to overcome your aversion. There are only small noises. So as Ajahn Chah once told us, it's not the noise that disturbs you. It is you who disturb the noise. So if someone snores, and it's gone in a second, but it keeps going on in our head. Why are they snoring? They shouldn't be snoring, not in here. Or, you know, they make a big noise when they come in here. Why do they keep doing that? Why do they bang the door? Don't they know there's a sign on here? Don't they know I'm trying to get into jhana? The sound of the door has long disappeared. But your thoughts about it, they last a long time. And it's the thoughts afterwards which disturb you more than any sound of any person. So that's what Ajahn Chah said. It's not the sound that disturbs you. You disturb the sound. That made this big aversion out of it. But nevertheless, it's a good point. Please try. And remember what I said about being burglar? If you come in here, you'd have all gone to jail by now. So try and sit down without hardly any noise at all. And leave without banging the door. Just do it slowly. And don't have any like plastic bags and stuff which rustle, which you know you're pretty good at. Like anything which makes any noise, out of kindness to people. And if you are tired, go and have a rest. Don't try and force yourself through it. And if it really is disturbing to you, why not meditate in your room? You've got your own little cave there. You can lock the door, pull down the shutters, and it's like nice and dark and quiet. So you can meditate there if you wish. Or if you don't mind meditating here, like many have already done, you've walked over to Bodhinyana and meditated in the meditation hall there. There's so many nice places to meditate around here, so you can take your choice. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned scientific talks by Rupert Sheldrake and others. Could you please repeat where to find them on the internet? Oh, that was on the TEDx channel. TEDx. It's apparently people who know the internet. So it's a very famous internet site where you've got some radical, challenging views. And it was on there. It was banned from there. Because the main part of his talk, he said, science, you know, the differentiating between scientific method and scientific dogma. And he said, science is dogmatic. And people said, no, it's not dogmatic. We're open to anything. Because he said that, his video, the first, I think, ever, was banned and taken off the channel. He said, see, it proves it. I was banned. Because it was too challenging. Lastly, is there any difference between empathy and compassion? Of course there is. Empathy is feeling your pain. I've got enough pain for myself, thank you. I don't want to feel all of yours. So that's empathy, is actually feeling what other people feel. And compassion, you don't have to feel what other people feel to actually just wish them well. So you wish them well. You can't have empathy for someone who's got cancer unless you've got cancer or you've had cancer. You can always have compassion for them. So you can't have empathy with me because you've never been monk before. But at least you can have compassion for me and let me go so I can have a nice night's sleep after a very busy day. So thank you all and may you have a wonderful night. Oh, it's just on 9 o'clock. So, three massive sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.